around here.
And that program is coming up next here over WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web, a special presentation of Ecologic. Stay tuned.
Healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic's Rachel Carson Special.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
This year, 2022, marks 60 years since the publication of Silent Spring, and this week is the groundbreaking environmental author Rachel Carson's 115th birthday. This is a perfect time to reflect on how the past informs the present.
Silent Spring was first published in the New Yorker magazine, and it was very influential right away.
You will hear Rachel Carson herself.
In 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's seminal work, Uncle Tom's Cabin, drove a nail into the institution of slavery that at first significantly crippled and ultimately helped end it worldwide as any form of respectable human endeavor. 54 years later, Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, brought to light the grisly secrets of U.S. meat production in much the same way. Again, as a result of one book, the United States standards in production, processing, and distribution of food were destined to become the gold standard for humans worldwide. A further leap of 60 years, and another author, a woman again, awakens the nation and the world in a single volume. As ahead of her time as science fiction, marine biologist Rachel Carson's Silent Spring predicted the death of the natural world and laid the blame at the hallowed doorstep of the modern age's burgeoning giants of the chemical industry. So powerful was her evocation of the hazards of the industry's miracle pesticide DDT, so eloquent her questioning of humanity's wisdom and its blind faith in technology, that a massive environmental movement arose like a tidal wave to sweep the surface of the earth. Earth, Rachel Carson, from her 1962 speech to the Women's National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
My text this afternoon is taken from the Globe Times of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, a news item in the issue of October 12th. After describing in detail the reactions to Silent Spring of the farm bureaus in two Pennsylvania counties, the reporter continued, "No one in either county farm office who was talked to today had read the book, but all disapproved of it heartily." I think this sums up very neatly the background of some of the noisier comment that has been heard in this unquiet autumn following the publication of Silent Spring. And in the words of an editorial in the Bennington Banner, "The anguished reaction to Silent Spring has been to refute statements that were never made." Early in the summer, as soon as the first installment of the book appeared in the New Yorker, public reaction was reflected first in a tidal wave of letters. Letters to congressmen, letters to government agencies, to newspapers, and to the author. These letters continue to come, and I am sure that they represent the most important and lasting reaction to the book. Then, even before the book itself was published, editorials and columns by the scores and even hundreds had discussed it all over the country, reflecting, I am sure, the true importance of the subject. The early reaction in the chemical press was rather moderate, and in fact, I have had and still have fine support from some segments of the chemical press and some segments of the agricultural press. But in general, as was to be expected, the industry press was not happy. And by late summer, the printing presses of the pesticide industry and their trade associations had begun to pour out the first of a growing stream of pamphlets and booklets designed to protect and repair the somewhat battered image of pesticides.
Chemical and Engineering News, August 13, 1962. Industry maps defense to pesticide criticisms. Moving gingerly, the pesticides industry is getting lined up to defend itself against the criticisms of Rachel Carson. Miss Carson's series of three articles, published in June in the New Yorker, are just a hint, the industry fears, of what is to come. Most industry men to whom Chemical and Engineering News has talked feel Miss Carson presents facts accurately for the most part, but comes to unwarranted conclusions from them and ignores the benefits of pesticides. Waiting for the other shoe to drop, the industry is now preparing for Miss Carson's book, Silent Spring, which will be published September 27th. Meanwhile, the government is also concerned. In response, at least in part, to Miss Carson's articles, the Federal Council for Science and Technology has set up an ad hoc committee to review present government activities with respect to pesticides and other chemicals in the environment. Mr. Jones says the Carson articles present nothing new, that they are highly dramatized presentations, but that they have aroused a great deal of public interest.
And plans have been announced for quarterly mailings to opinion leaders and for monthly statements to press and radio. The speakers are going out all over the country. So it is clear that we are to receive heavy doses of tranquilizing information designed to lull the public to sleep from which it had been so rudely awakened. Now, some definite gains have been made toward a saner policy of pest control in recent months. And I think the important issue now is whether we are to hold and to extend those gains. The attack on Silent Spring is now falling into a rather definite pattern, and all the well-known devices are being used. Of course, one obvious way to weaken a cause is to discredit the person who champions it. And so the masters of invective have been busy. I am a bird lover, a cat lover, a fish lover. I am a priestess of nature, and I am a devotee of some mystical cult that has to do with laws of the universe, which my critics somehow consider themselves immune to.
In the New Yorker series, Ms. Carson says that use of pesticides has killed or injured people, livestock, and wildlife, as well as the pests. She says that it is upsetting the balance of nature and may be wrecking our genetic heritage. She cites case after case of fish and bird kills following insecticide applications and cases of human deaths following use of pesticides. Her most scathing words are used against area-wide aerial spraying, which she terms chemical rain, chemical downpour, or even chemical fallout. These campaigns have at times been not only harmful to wildlife, she says, but also ineffective against the pests they were meant to control. Pleading for a large-scale conversion to biological and other methods that would leave no residues on foods, she says, as things stand now, we are a little better off than guests of the Borgias. However, she claims that she is not against every use of pesticides.
Another well-known and much-used device is to misrepresent my position and then to attack the things that I've never said. Now, I don't want to belabor the obvious, because anyone who has really read the book knows that I do favor insect control in appropriate situations, that I do not advocate the complete abandonment of chemical control, that I criticize modern chemical control not because it controls harmful insects, but because it controls them badly and inefficiently, and because it creates many dangerous side effects in doing so. I criticize the present methods because they are based on a rather low level of scientific thinking. We really are capable of much greater sophistication in our solution of this problem.
The National Agricultural Chemicals Association now has a position paper on the New Yorker articles. The Manufacturing Chemists Association also has a policy statement. MCA's statement talks generally about chemicals and the environment, does not mention Ms. Carson or her book specifically, although it does respond to some of her contentions. However, MCA President John Hull says in a letter to member firms accompanying the statement that Ms. Carson's articles, like many others before them, are a warning that thinking people are concerned about the misuse of chemicals, and that for the most part they lack the information on which to base intelligent judgment. He believes the industry must bring the information to them as accurately, thoroughly, quickly, and objectively as possible. NACA's statement argues that two federal laws, the Miller Pesticides Amendment and the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, provide adequate safeguards to the public health. It also recalls numerous investigations of the industry and the effect of its product by committees of Congress, the National Academy of Sciences, the U.S. Public Health Service, and governor's committees in many states. All of these, it says, concluded that pesticides must be used to produce food and fiber, that they must be and are being safely tested before use, and that they must be carefully and wisely applied. Most producers of pesticides aren't commenting for publication about the Carson articles, preferring instead to let their trade associations carry the ball. The list of companies that refused Chemical and Engineering News's invitation to comment reads like a who's who for the pesticides industry. 10 or 12 companies are preparing point-by-point rebuttals to the New Yorker series for their own use. Meanwhile, little has been heard in defense of pesticides from the government agencies which regulate the industry. The Department of Agriculture, severely criticized in the articles, has made no official statement, nor has the Food and Drug Administration. Unofficially, an FDA spokesman says the articles are obviously, perhaps also intentionally, one-sided. He says the cases Ms. Carson cites are almost all cases of misuse, but he believes the articles could have a good effect by warning of the dangers of misuse.
But Rachel Carson had her supporters as well as her critics.
In case after case, Ms. Carson succeeds in documenting her thesis with complete adequacy. It is not pleasant to learn of the casual spraying of the landscape with chemicals capable of mutagenic effects and regarded by some authorities as representing as great a menace as high levels of radiation. Nor is it reassuring to read that the hydrocarbons have an affinity for mammalian germ cells. At present, there is no law on the statute books that requires manufacturers to demonstrate the genetic effects, as distinguished from the toxicity, of their concoctions. Nor is there any way of controlling what the average uninformed farmer may do with his insecticides. An equally ill-educated and impatient public wants its weeds, gnats, and mosquitoes eliminated in one fell blow. It is not sophisticated enough to trouble over the looming demise of our beautiful national bird, the bald eagle, nor to connect the return of many supposedly eliminated pests with the fact that the newer generation may be able to flourish in a sack of DDT and thus be twice as formidable. The biological controls which Miss Carson favors, along with other informed biologists, are not just more careful and discreet use of pesticides, but also such clever natural manipulations as the release of sterilized screwworm flies, causing a greater reduction in the population of this parasite than any insecticide would have achieved. Successful experiments such as this depend upon precise knowledge of the life history of an organism. They strike directly at the heart of the problem. They do not leave poisonous residues or resistant life strains, nor do they result in the mass killing that frequently destroys valuable food chains on which even man is in the long run dependent. All of these facts Rachel Carson has set forth sensibly in the quiet, rational prose for which she is famous. If her present book does not possess the beauty of The Sea Around Us, it is because she has courageously chosen, at the height of her powers, to educate us upon a sad, an unpleasant, an unbeautiful topic, and one of our own making. Silent Spring should be read by every American who does not want it to be the epitaph of a world not very far beyond us in time.
Another piece in the pattern of attack largely ignores Silent Spring and concentrates on what I suppose would be called the soft sell, the soothing reassurances to the public. Some of these acknowledge that my facts are correct, but they say that the incidents I reported all occurred in the past, that these things are well known now, and that measures have been taken to prevent their recurrence. Now, it must be assumed that the people reading these reassurances do not read other things in the newspaper, because actually pesticides have figured rather prominently in the news in recent months. Some of the incidents trivial, some almost humorous, and some quite important. In general, they do not differ greatly from the type of incidents that have occurred over past years in which I reported. Now, what are some of the ways that pesticides are making news now? Well, let me give you just a few examples. The New York Post of October 12th reported the seizure by the Food and Drug Administration of more than 250,000 pounds of potatoes in the Pacific Northwest. The agents of the Food and Drug Administration had found that they contained about 4 times the permitted residues of dieldrin and aldrin. A few weeks ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service reported on studies of the eagle in relation to insecticides. I think almost everyone knows that the bald eagle, our national emblem, is seriously declining in numbers. The service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, has now measured the lethal dose of DDT in the eagle. It has done this by controlled feeding experiments. What is particularly important is that it has now found that dead eagles found in the wild are carrying the lethal dose or more than the lethal dose of DDT. Other studies on the occurrence of DDT in the eggs and partially developed embryos of eggs that have failed to reach mature development also suggest a factor there in the failure of eagle reproduction. This fall also, Canadian papers carried a warning that woodcock being shot by hunters in New Brunswick were carrying residues of heptachlor and might be dangerous if used as food. Now, woodcock are migratory birds. Those that nest in New Brunswick migrate to the southern United States, where heptachlor has been used extensively in the fire ant program. The residues in the birds were 3 to 3.5 parts per million. The legal tolerance for heptachlor is 0. Now, very recently, biologists in the Massachusetts Fish and Game Department have reported that fish in the Framingham Reservoir, just outside Boston, are carrying residues of DDT as high as 75 parts per million. This is 10 times the legal tolerance. This is, of course, a public water supply for a large number of people. An Associated Press dispatch of November 16th, a sad little commentary on technology gone wrong. A federal court jury awarded a New York State farmer damages for his potato crop. The damage was done by a chemical that was supposed to stop sprouting. Instead, the sprouts grew inward. We're told also that chemicals are never used unless tests have shown them to be safe. Now, this, of course, is not an accurate statement. I am happy to see that the Department of Agriculture plans to ask the Congress to amend the Federal Insecticide, Rodenticide, and Fungicide Act to do away with the provision that now permits a company to register a chemical under protest, even though a question of health or safety has been raised by the department. We have other reminders that unsafe chemicals get into use. County agents, for example, frequently have to amend or rescind earlier advices on the use of pesticides. For example, I saw a letter the other day, recently sent out to farmers, recalling stocks of a chemical that had been used as a cattle spray. Just in September, there were unexplained losses among cattle following its use. Several suspected lots were recalled, but the losses continued. And now all outstanding lots of the chemical have had to be recalled. The inaccurate statements in reviews of Silent Spring are a dime a dozen, and I shall only mention one or two examples. Time, in its discussion of Silent Spring, described accidental poisonings from pesticides as very rare. Well, let's look at a few figures. California, the one state that keeps complete and accurate records, reports from 900 to 1,000 cases of poisoning from agricultural chemicals per year. About 200 of those are from the chemical parathion alone.
That was Rachel Carson, one of the most important Americans in history. This is an ecologic special for Rachel Carson's birthday and the 60th anniversary of her influential book, Silent Spring, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
You can get Rachel Carson's whole talk and many other women of history for a donation of $100 to WBAI FM at www.givetowbai.org. Search for women or call 212-209-2950 and ask for the Women's History Month thumb drive.
Coming up is more from Rachel Carson and a clip from Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers Union.
In January of 1963, thousands of influential citizens received a letter from C.G. King, president of the Nutrition Foundation, Incorporated.
I am writing you because many responsible citizens, including both scientists and non-scientists, are increasingly concerned about the promotion of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. Publicists and the author's adherents among the food faddists, health quacks, and special interest groups are promoting her book as if it was scientifically irreproachable and written by a scientist. Neither is true, but that a long and happy life awaits if only we will buy or follow Panacea X.
Cesar Chavez, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, in a talk he gave in 1968.
See, we have now in California and in all areas of the country, we've made great advances in pesticides and insecticides. And the university in California, and universities all over the country, I'm sure, especially in farm states, know how many bugs each pesticide or insecticide is going to kill. They know exactly how many it's going to kill and how long they will remain dead. But they don't know, and they don't care to know, is what effect it has on the human being. They don't care. So it's very, very, very serious. Let me tell you, 3 weeks ago, our small clinic that we have in Delano, it's housed in a house trailer, a lady came in. She had been handling this very highly poisonous chemical. She came in, she began to lose her fingernails. Eventually, she lost all of her fingernails. See, what happens is that you don't know what's happening, because if you handle any of this highly toxic chemicals, you don't feel the effects. You don't know the effects immediately. It's 2 weeks, 4, 6 weeks later, you begin to have some effects. Not right away. For instance, we have many cases where a member, a farm worker, will be spraying these very dangerous chemicals, and then he's all over this. He sprayed for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a week, and it's all over. 6 weeks later, he begins to have problems with his vision. He comes to the doctor, and he can't see well, or there's something wrong. Cases where people will use the insecticides, and then 2 months, 3 months later, they begin to get skin poisoning. See, it takes such a long time to begin to work. It's a very slow thing that we're always having great arguments on the industrial accident cases, they don't want to take into consideration. If you were to say, well, they're in California, I'm in New York, and, well, we have so many other human needs, they can take care of themselves. How do you know? How do you know? Or how do I know if some of those residues of those sprays are not on those grapes? So you don't want to do it because of convictions, do it because of your health.
That was Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers in 1968, continuing Rachel Carson's work educating about and combating indiscriminate pesticide use. People were listening to Cesar Chavez because Rachel Carson had already presented the science of pesticides and human health. I had to laugh at the critic who said Rachel Carson was not a scientist. Since when is marine biology not a science?
DDT was banned in the U.S. as a result of Silent Spring and the studies Rachel Carson publicized of its effects on eggshells of birds of prey. What DDT did was make the eggshells so thin that when the birds sat on the eggs to incubate them, the eggs broke. They weren't able to reproduce for many years. Ms. Carson probably saved the bald eagle from extinction, at least in the lower 48 states, and also the peregrine falcon and osprey, as a result of the DDT ban. The bald eagle vanished in a number of states for years, until quite some time after the ban. It took years to get enough DDT out of the environment for the eagles to successfully breed again.
As Linda Lear, a biographer of Rachel Carson, says, as our own consciousness of the natural world and the new threats against it grow, it is amazing to see how relevant Rachel Carson's views remain.
And I would add, disturbing, given that we have not made more progress in 60 years.
Every environmental group that started after 1962 owes its existence to Silent Spring.
One factor in getting an above-ground nuclear testing ban was Rachel Carson getting the science of these nuclear tests' effects on human health to such people as President Kennedy. One of the many reasons why we can refer to her as one of the most important Americans in history.
This talk by Rachel Carson has been excerpted from a one-hour radio show that is archived on the Pacifica Women's History Month thumb drive. Besides Rachel Carson, the thumb drive contains 49 more hours of and about important women such as Margaret Mead, Emma Goldman, Helen Caldicott, Molly Ivins, Lena Horne, Sarah Vaughan, Amy Goodman, and many more.
This can all be yours for a $100 donation to WBAI-FM. Call 212-209-2950 and ask for the Women's History Month thumb drive. If you're online, click donate at www.givetowbai.org. Then put women in the search box and the thumb drive will come right up.
The full Rachel Carson segment on the thumb drive is longer than what we have time to play for you today. It's not available in stores. The only way to hear it is by getting the Women's History Month USB thumb drive.
You can listen to this entire interview and hear many more amazing women. Betty Friedan, Bella Abzug, Odetta, Lillian Hellman, many more, for a donation of $100 or more. Donating to WBAI in the name of Ecologic helps keep us on the air, really. Help WBAI continue to bring you important news, information, and entertainment. Radio might seem free, but there are costs, and our listener-supported radio station needs you.
You can hear Rachel Carson's strength and intelligence throughout her talk to the Women's Press Club. Now, there was a Women's Press Club because in 1962, women were not allowed at the press club itself. Yet even with that restriction, Rachel Carson made her information well known and created an environmental movement that has outlived her by 58 years and counting.
The Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act have been around for 50 years. Yes, the Cuyahoga River catching fire in Cleveland helped get those laws passed. But if there were not an environmental movement to shine a light on that river fire, the fire may have become a footnote, not a seminal event.
By the way, Ecologic will be addressing the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts later this year. This Friday at 2:30 p.m. on Rachel Carson's actual birthday, May 27th, we'll be devoting our entire show to her. Please join us.
We don't have time to play the whole Rachel Carson show for you, but you can get this whole talk Along with 49 other historic interviews of women from the arts, science, politics, Jane Fonda, Wangari Maathai, by donating $100 to WBAI-FM. Go to www.givetowbai.org, search for women, or call 212-209-2950 and ask for the Women's History Drive.
You might remember hearing other excerpts from the Women's History Month thumb drive on WBAI during Women's History Month in March. Here's another chance to get one, or get one for your friends and relatives. You're going to want to play these interviews for your friends, your relatives, or for your favorite teacher. You might want extra thumb drives to give away as gifts.
These thumb drives would make a great addition to your local library or high school. This history should be widely available. All 50 files are very important to listen to. Please share it with your teacher. Please share it.
Rachel Carson is the 12th of 50 files, a total running time of 2 days, 1 hour, and 6 minutes. Oh, but take some breaks. You can spread that out over a week or more and keep coming back to listen to these historic interviews. Almost 50 hours of our history preserved and available to you for a donation of $100 to WBAI. That's just $2 an hour. What can you get for $2 today? Not even a subway ride.
The drive is playable on any computer with a USB port. Once you plug the thumb drive into your computer should recognize it as another drive, and you can see the list of all the people on the drive. Some of the women on this thumb drive are relatively unknown, and you'll enjoy discovering them.
Rachel Carson is such an important figure in American history, and it's great that her address to the Women's Press Club has been preserved, and even better that it's available to you.
Many of the chemical industry's attacks on Rachel Carson in 1962 are going to sound awfully familiar to anyone active on pesticide or pollution issues today. You'll hear how Rachel Carson dealt with her attackers, and it's a good lesson of what we can do today.
In the next clip, you'll hear one of Rachel Carson's critics from the chemical industry, and then Rachel Carson herself calmly commenting on what he said.
You're listening to Ecologic's Rachel Carson special here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
I.L. Baldwin, professor of agricultural bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin, had this to say.
The possible indirect harmful effects of pesticides on human and wildlife are stressed in Silent Spring. It is noted that certain of the pesticides may serve as carcinogens and that some may serve as mutagens. How often all the necessary conditions are met so that pesticides do actually serve as carcinogens or mutagens is unknown. The author feels that such dangers are very great. Most scientists who are familiar with the field, including government workers charged with the responsibility of safeguarding the public health, feel that the danger of damage is slight. Another example in which the author's choice of language may lead to false impressions is her reference to the fall of chemical death rain. Many may be led to believe that just as rain falls on all of our land, so is all of our land sprayed with pesticides. The story of Silent Spring, so well told by Rachel Carson, even though it presents only one side of a very complex problem, will serve a useful purpose if research on better methods of pest control is stimulated, and if all concerned with the production, control, and use of pesticides are stimulated to exercise greater care in the protection of the public welfare.
Florida has experienced so many poisonings recently that the state is now attempting to control and to curtail the use of some of the more dangerous pesticides in residential areas. It's also worthy of notice that during the years 1959, 1960, and 1961, airplane crashes involving crop dusting planes totaled 873. In these accidents, 135 pilots lost their lives. This very fact led to some very significant research by the Federal Aviation Agency through its Civil Aeromedical Unit. This research, which has just been reported on in brief, was designed to find out why so many of these planes crashed. And these medical investigators took as their basic premise the assumption that spray poisons do accumulate within the body of the pilot, that they accumulate within the cell where they are difficult to detect. Now, the report that was recently issued contained two very significant facts, which the researchers had confirmed. One, that there is a causal relation between the buildup of toxins in the cell and the onset of sugar diabetes. Two, that the buildup of poisons within the cell interferes with the rate of energy production in the human body. I, of course, am happy to have this confirmation that cellular processes are not so irrelevant as a certain scientific reviewer of Silent Spring has declared them to be.
Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers.
Oil companies are the ones that produce the pesticides, and they're just going to stop at no end. Malathion, it's related to the parathion that was used in Germany. The nerve gases, I mean, it's a very dangerous poison. But here they sprayed it all over everything. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. But it shows the dangers of government. And again, why we have to participate. We just cannot afford to not get involved politically. It's just too big of a risk.
William J. Darby, head of the Department of Biochemistry and director of the Division of Nutrition at Vanderbilt University, criticized Ms. Carson's language and her scholarship.
Man has, according to Ms. Carson, now upset that ideal state of adjustment and balance of life on this planet through synthetic creations of man's inventive mind, brewed in his laboratory and having no counterpart in nature. These products are staggering in number, have power to kill, have incredible potential for harm, represent a train of disaster, result in chemical death rain, and are being used with little or no advance investigation of their effect on soil, water, wildlife, and man himself. She further warns the reader that all of these sinister chemicals will not only extinguish plant life, wildlife, aquatic life, and man, but they will produce cancer, leukemia, sterility, and cellular mutations. There are 297 pages devoted to reiteration of these views. There then follows a 55-page list of principal sources. If it inspires some users to read and heed labels more carefully, it may aid in the large educational effort in which industry, government, colleges, and many other groups are engaged. The responsible scientist should read this book to understand the ignorance of those writing on the subject and the educational task which lies ahead.
And this same reviewer writing in a chemical journal was much annoyed with me for giving the sources of my information. To identify the person whose views you are quoting is, according to this reviewer, name-dropping. Well, times have certainly changed since I received my training in scientific methods at Johns Hopkins. My critic also disapproved profoundly of my bibliography. The very fact that it gave complete and specific references for each important statement was extremely distasteful to him. This was padding, he said, to impress the uninitiated with its length. Now, I would just like to say that in Silent Spring, I've never asked the reader to take my word. I have given him a very clear indication of my sources. I make it possible, indeed I urge him, to go beyond what I report to get the full picture. And this is the reason for the 55 pages of references. You can't do this if you're trying to conceal or distort or present half-truths. Another reviewer was offended because I made the statement that it is customary for pesticide manufacturers to support research on chemicals in the universities. Now, this is just common knowledge, and I can scarcely believe that the reviewer was unaware of it because his own university is among those receiving such grants. But since my statement has been challenged, I suggest that any of you who are interested make a few inquiries from representative universities, and I am sure you will find that the practice is very widespread. In fact, a visit to any good science library will provide the evidence, because it is customary in technical papers for the authors to acknowledge the source of their funds. Just an example or two gleaned at random from the Journal of Economic Entomology. A paper from the University of Wisconsin carries the note, this research was also supported in part by grants from the Shell Chemical Company, Velsicol Chemical Corporation, and Wisconsin Canners Association. Another paper from the Illinois Natural History Survey declares this investigation was sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company of St. Louis, Missouri. A penetrating observer of social problems has pointed out recently that whereas wealthy families once were the chief benefactors of the universities, now industry has taken over this role. Now, of course, supportive education is something no one quarrels with, but this need not blind us to the fact that research supported by the pesticide manufacturers is not likely to be directed at discovering facts unfavorable to the continuance of current practices. Such a liaison between science and industry is a growing phenomenon, but seen in other areas as well. For example, the American Medical Association, through its newspaper, has just referred physicians to a pesticide trade association for information to help them answer patients' questions about the effects of pesticides on man. Now, I am sure physicians have a need for greater information on this subject, but I would like to see them referred to authoritative scientific or medical literature and not to a trade organization whose interest it is to promote the sale of pesticides. We see scientific societies acknowledging as sustaining associates a dozen or more giants of a related industry. Now, when the scientific organization speaks, whose voice do we hear? The voice of science or the voice of industry? It might be a less serious situation if this were clarified, for I think the public assumes it is hearing the voice of science.
And Frederick J. Stare, chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard, criticized her scientific detachment.
Since food faddists, theater critics, news commentators, and other self-appointed protectors of the public welfare have written critical estimates of Silent Spring, Miss Rachel Carson's controversial book on the effect of agricultural chemicals on man's environment, a very large part of Miss Carson's work touches on the matter of the safety and wholesomeness of our food supply.
And what does it mean when we see a committee set up to make a supposedly impartial review of a situation and then discover that the committee is affiliated with the very industry whose profits are at stake? I have just this week read two reviews of the recent reports of a National Academy of Sciences committee on the relations of pesticides to wildlife. These comments, these reviews on these reports raise rather disturbing questions. It's important to understand what this committee is. The two sections of its report that have now been published are frequently cited by the pesticide industry in attempts to refute my statements. The public, I believe, assumes that the committee is actually part of the academy. It is appointed by the academy, but its members come from outside. Some, of course, are scientists of distinction in their fields. But one would suppose that the way to get an impartial evaluation of such a problem, the impact of pesticides on wildlife, would be to set up a committee of completely disinterested individuals. Now, the review that appears this week in the Atlantic Naturalist describes the composition of this committee as follows. A very significant role in this committee is played by the liaison representatives. These are of three categories: A, supporting agencies; B, government agencies; C, scientific societies. The supporting agencies are presumably those who supply the hard cash. 43 such agencies are listed, including 19 chemical companies comprising the massed might of chemical industry. In addition, there are at least 4 trade organizations. The committee reports begin with a firm statement in support of the use of chemical pesticides. From this predetermined position, it is not surprising to find it mentioning only some damage to some species of wildlife. And since in what appears to be the modern manner there is no documentation, one can neither confirm nor deny these findings. The Atlantic Naturalist reviewer described these reports as, quotes, written in the style of a trained public relations official of industry out to placate some segments of the public that were causing trouble, end quote. All these things raise the question of the communication of scientific knowledge to the public.
Her warnings have been grimly illustrated. 10 million fish died of endrin and dieldrin poisoning in the Mississippi River. Parathion poisoning reached epidemic proportions among orchard workers in Stanislaus County, California, and evidence of insect resistance to insecticides continues to grow. Influential groups and agencies have called for more stringent control over the use of pesticides. Hearings have been held, and companies have been investigated.
The earth has a problem with a hard drug, and we are among the victims. That drug is the pesticide DDT and its breakdown products. This chemical used to be a good trip. It saved millions of people from death by malaria, typhus, and other insect-borne diseases, and it saved billions of dollars in crops from insect pests. Now we are finding out that DDT has been doing a whole lot of other things, subtle things, like killing animals because it keeps them from reproducing. The trouble is that the pushers, the men who make money by selling this land drug, mostly in California, have got us hooked. They sell it to us, and worse yet, to underdeveloped nations all over the world, many of whom do not use it as cautiously as we do. It may ruin them in the end. DDT is a funny thing. It can last for decades because it doesn't fall apart like other chemicals. Thus, the world is on a bum trip now from which it may not recover. Secondly, it evaporates with water and enters the winds, so it spreads itself over the whole world. Thirdly, it clings to small particles, so it gets eaten easily by animals. Finally, it magnifies itself in animals. It exists in low concentrations in water, but plants and animals collect it selectively, and as it moves up the food chain from plant-eating animals to animals that eat other animals, it gets more and more concentrated. We found out that DDT can reduce the photosynthesis and growth of plankton, and it's already reached a high enough level in some bays to do this. Marine plankton is where most of the world's oxygen comes from. It has begun to damage oysters and shrimps. Crab fisheries on both coasts of the United States have declined, and DDT is the reason. Carnivorous fish in enclosed seas and lakes have started to exceed the legal limit of DDT for human consumption. The Lake Michigan coho salmon is already too contaminated to eat. Marine fishes on our coast are getting close to the legal limit. Some freshwater fish, such as trout in some areas of the country, that are supposedly still safe to eat are suffering reproductive damage, so there are fewer and fewer of them. And we are beginning to suspect that some marine fish, such as the salmon, are not behaving correctly because of very low DDT concentrations. The worst damaged animals are the birds. Do you like those funny-looking fish-eating birds with the big sacks under their long necks, the pelicans? None of them on the California coast laid eggs this year. They laid omelets. Their calcium balance is messed up by DDT. We may lose the peregrine falcon, the bald eagle, the osprey, the petrels, and perhaps a whole lot more.
Rachel Carson died on April 14, 1964, a little less than 2 years after the publication of Silent Spring. The ideas which she expressed in the opening paragraphs of The Edge of the Sea formed her conceptual framework, and they were part of the working vocabulary of the biological scientist. But with the publication of Silent Spring, these ideas entered into the popular vocabulary, and in so doing, became part of the complex environment she so beautifully described. Rachel Carson has affected that environment in ways not yet possible to assess.
She renewed or reassured us of the importance of the evolutionary force that we may have forgotten. She reminds us that if we compare technology with the evolutionary force, we're comparing maybe two centuries with forever. And in the course of a century or two, with some very bright thinking and writing and research, we think we can second-guess all that. And I guess some of the chemical companies thought so more than others, that in order to sustain an ever-increasing population, that we should feel perfectly free to eradicate any other living thing that seems to be competing with us.
Is industry becoming a screen through which facts must be filtered so that the hard, uncomfortable truths are kept back and only the harmless morsels are allowed to filter through? I know that many thoughtful scientists are deeply disturbed that their organizations are becoming fronts for industry. More than one scientist has raised the question of whether a spirit of Lysenkoism may be developing in America today. The philosophy that perverted and destroyed the science of genetics in Russia and even infiltrated all of that nation's agricultural sciences. But here, the tailoring, the screening of basic truth, is done not to suit any party line, but to accommodate to the short-term gain, serve the gods of profit and production.
That was Rachel Carson. This is an Ecologic special for Rachel Carson's birthday and the 60th anniversary of her influential book, Silent Spring, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
It's been so great to hear Rachel Carson herself defending the environment against her critics. You can hear all of Ms. Carson at the National Women's Press Club by contributing to WBAI. She is included on the Women's History Month thumb drive, along with 49 other women, almost 50 hours of women's history for a donation of only $100. That comes to about $2 an hour for incredible interviews with women from the arts, science, and politics, interviews and information you will never hear on mainstream media.
Wasn't it great when Rachel Carson pointed out that many of her critics in the chemical industry admitted to never reading Silent Spring, but they still knew they didn't like or approve of it? You'll want to own a copy of this interview to play for or give to your friends and relatives.
Our next show, this Friday, May 27th, 2:30 p.m., will be a birthday celebration of Rachel Carson, who fought cancer for more than a decade before she died too young.
We thank the Rachel Carson Institute and the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society for their help. They have lots of information at www.rachelcarson.org. On the Ecologic website, www.ecoradio.org, we have information on a variety of environmental topics. You can listen to the show or any of our past shows. It's all at www.ecoradio.org.
Mainstream media will sometimes do biographical shows on people like Rachel Carson. They almost have to. But how often do you get to hear so much of the voices of those who are gone? WBAI has been on the air for 62 years and Pacifica for 73, and we have a wealth of such information, and we rely on your help to keep broadcasting.
WBAI doesn't accept ads or donations from corporations, so you'll hear us asking for your support, but always with the reward of information that is not available elsewhere. We need you for Ecologic and WBAI to exist.
BAI buddy pledges are especially important. They help the station with planning a budget, ensure that ongoing expenses are covered. Please join us with a monthly donation so we can keep bringing you these unique programs.
Ecologic and WBAI continue to offer you important news, information, and entertainment. Radio might seem free, but there are costs. Like everyone, the station has rent to pay. We do a lot with a very small paid staff and many volunteers. We know how to stretch a dollar, but we need a few dollars to keep us going.
Rent, payroll, transmitter tower, the basic necessities of maintaining this historic radio station that amplifies so many voices that would otherwise not have an outlet. Keep us the truly community radio station that we are. Your support, the support of our Ecologic listeners, means everything.
Go to www.givetowbai.org and click donate, then scroll down to premium selection, then search for women, and the thumb drive will come right up. Or call 212-209-2950 and ask for the Women's History Drive or to become an Ecologic BAI buddy with a monthly contribution.
Pledging now during this show really helps Ecologic especially.
The full Rachel Carson segment on the thumb drive is longer than what we have time to play for you today. It's not available in stores. The only way to hear it all is by getting the Women's History Month USB thumb drive.
The drive is playable on any computer with a USB port. Once you plug the thumb drive into your computer should recognize it as another drive, and you can see the list of all the people on the drive. Some of the women on this thumb drive are relatively unknown, and you'll enjoy discovering them.
You can listen to this entire interview and hear 50 amazing women, Betty Friedan, Jane Fonda, Wangari Maathai, Lillian Heldman, many more, for a donation of at least $100. Giving to WBAI in the name of Ecologic keeps us on the air. Really? Help WBAI continue to bring you important news, information, and entertainment. Radio might seem free, but there are costs, and our listener-supported radio station needs you.
We can't play the entire Rachel Carson show for you, but you can get her whole talk, along with 49 other historic interviews of women from the arts, science, politics, Bella Abzug, Odetta, and more, by donating $100 to BAI FM. Go to www.givetowbai.org, click donate, search for women, or call 212-209-2950.
Did you hear other excerpts from this thumb drive during Women's History Month in March? You'll be thrilled with how much history it contains, over 2 days worth. Here's another chance to get one for yourself. Or as a gift for a friend, relative, even your favorite teacher or librarian. You're going to want to play these interviews often. and maybe get extra thumb drives to give away as gifts.
These thumb drives would make a great donation to your local library or high school, helping both WBAI and your local community. This history should be available to everyone. Some women you've known about for years. Others may be new to you. These audio recordings are not available anywhere else. Priceless history for just $2 an hour. $100 total for almost 50 hours of fascinating archives.
So those of you online, please sign up for our email list on www.ecoradio.org. Those of you on social media, search for Eco-Logic.
And thanks to our much appreciated engineer, Michael G. Haskins. We couldn't do this without you.
I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us at 2:30 p.m. this Friday, May 27th, her actual birthday, to hear more about Rachel Carson.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
So solar power, inexpensive energy. So
that was a special presentation of Eco-Logic. Thank you so much to Sally Gellert, Donna Stein, and Ken Gale, and we look forward to their program, Eco-Logic, celebrating Rachel Carson's birthday on the 27th. This is listener-supported, commercial-free Radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Well done pitching throughout that entire program, fundraising, asking for you, those of you listening right now to this special program, to support radio station WBAI.
This is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
There's a war on the way, don't you know it? Can't you see it?
Build
Building Bridges, your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Bringing you news and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m. We build bridges. And it's time we started calling.